Clinical research on adjuvant chemotherapy for non-small cell lung cancer has undergone a revolution in the last 3 years. First, with a clear-cut demonstration that this treatment strategy works, but then for the controversial data presented from a major CALGB trial at the 2006 ASCO meeting. I asked Dr. Chandra Balani for his take on this and other critical research to practice issues in lung cancer, and he began our conversation by commenting on the CALGB trial.
Adjuvant therapy has now become the standard of care for patients with resected non-small cell lung cancer. Until 2005, it was the standard of care for patients with stage 1B to 3A disease. So now we have a brewing controversy in patients with stage 1B disease, whether we should give adjuvant therapy or not. The two questions that are being asked, or the two controversies which are there, include whether it was carboplatin which made the regimen of carboplatin and Taxol fail in 1B disease.
You're talking
because
about
the CALGB 9633 trial at long-term follow-up failed to show an improvement in survival, because the hazard ratio fell from 0.62 to 0.80, and the p-value is not significant. Now, there is a word of caution that that trial was still a small trial, still not a completed trial, because now the events have happened and we will see the results one more time in the future. The second issue is that the reason the trial failed is that they did not receive cisplatin-based therapy. So in general, if you look at the results of the other clinical trials, the JBR-10 study, the ILT study, and the ANITA trial, there is a role of adjuvant chemotherapy in stage 1B disease, because in those trials it was platinum-based chemotherapy which was used, or cisplatin-based chemotherapy. So I would recommend giving it to a patient with stage 1B disease. But the CLGB trial has shown a sub-analysis that patients who have greater than 4 centimeter size disease, there is still a benefit. But again, we are reading too much into the sub-analysis of these trials, which were not really clear endpoints of these clinical studies. So that's the controversy. So one would be whether we should give treatment for 1B disease, and the second is whether we should give carboplatin-based regimens.
What are your own personal answers in a non-protocol setting?
In a non-protocol setting for stage 1B disease, I offer it to the patient saying that in a small subset, it has shown a benefit, and in another subset, it has not shown a benefit, and let the patient decide whether he wants to take it or not.
But regimen?
If it is greater than 4 centimeters in size, then I usually suggest that they take it.
What regimen or regimen?
So the regimen which has been used in most of the clinical trials, which have shown positive results, is the cisplatin-vinorelbine. So if I were to be very objective and scientific, I would say cisplatin-vinorelbine is the regimen of choice, because that's the only regimen which has been studied in randomized trials which has shown a benefit over best supportive care. But I think that any cisplatin-based regimen is probably a reasonable alternative. In the U.S., most physicians do not use the cisplatin-vinorelbine regimen. So the two alternatives would be cis-docetaxel and cis-gemcitabine. So those are two reasonable alternatives in the adjuvant treatment setting.
What about the older patient with some comorbidities but still healthy enough to consider therapy?
So the older patient should be considered for adjuvant chemotherapy, because the JBR-10 trial actually looked at the elderly subset of patients. There were about 155 patients who were elderly amongst the JBR-10 trial. And there was still a significant benefit. If you look at the numbers are actually higher than the full trial. There was a 20% benefit with adjuvant chemotherapy in the elderly population. There was a 15% benefit in the overall population. But the magnitude is lower because there are comorbidities. So if 5-year survival was 69% versus 66% in the elderly population. So if the performance status is good and patient doesn't have any significant problems, I would offer cisplatin-based chemotherapy. Most patients are able to get only 3 cycles rather than 4.
Any situations where you use carbo in the adjuvant setting?
So that's the controversy which we talked about in stage 1B disease, where we are really benefiting the patients by giving a regimen such as carboplatin and Taxol, because we are here looking for that curative potential of the chemotherapy combination. So I have given it. I'm not saying I have not given it, but I'm shying away from it.
Where are we right now in terms of sort of the next generation of adjuvant trials, particularly the issue of looking at bevacizumab and also the issue of what chemo regimens we should be studying in the next generation?
Well, the next bevacizumab trial will be the only trial. It is ACOG 1505, and it has chosen three regimens, cisplatin-vinorelbine, cisplatin-docetaxel, and cisplatin-gemcitabine, with and without bevacizumab. And patients will be stage 1B who are greater than 4 centimeters in size, stage 2 and stage 3A without mediastinal nodes.
How do you think accrual is going to go to that trial considering there's no carbo option?
That's the question of the day. Whether the trial will accrue, so there are very many caveats. Whether the accrual to that trial will depend primarily on the results of the AVAIL study. So the AVAIL trial is being run in Europe, where cisplatin gemcitabine is being compared to two different doses of Avastin in combination with cisplatin and gemcitabine.
This is metastatic disease?
Metastatic disease.
What were your thoughts about the ECOG study looking at carbotaxol plus or minus Bev?
I think that's an excellent trial, which has shown significant but modest benefit in combination with carboplatin and paclitaxel. There is a 2-month survival difference, and this is the only trial which has shown 1-year survival greater than 50% in a select group of patients with metastatic and advanced lung cancer.
How has that trial affected your practice? Are you using bevacizumab in your patients?
Yeah, we are using bevacizumab in patients with non-squamous cell carcinoma outside of a study.
And what specific criteria are you using to use it?
Well, we are still following the ECOG 4599 criteria. So actually, outside of a study context, I would not recommend its use in patients with squamous cell carcinoma or patients with brain metastases, patients on anticoagulants.
What about treated brain metastases?
I think that's also being done in the context of a clinical trial. So I would still adhere to the clinical trial rather than using it outside of clinical study.
What have been your experiences utilizing bevacizumab?
I think it is a good drug, but there are problems with the complications that you see. Hypertension and hemorrhage is not trivial, and in certain patients, it is very difficult to control if it happens. The half-life of the drug is too long, and it's not just discontinuation of the drug, which changes the picture.
How do you approach the treatment of hypertension? Are you aggressive in terms of trying to lower it in patients with metastatic disease, or you kind of let it go a little bit higher than you might otherwise?
Yeah, we let it go a little bit higher. It usually comes down, and it's only a problem in a few patients.
What about hemorrhage? What are your thoughts about the observations? There was some more data presented at ASCO.
Yeah.
Can we identify patients at high risk for this?
I don't think we have been able to identify except for those centrally located tumors which cavitate, but none of the risk factors were identified except that if a patient had previous history of slight hemorrhage.
Have you yourself had patients with hemorrhage one day?
I have not had a patient. It's just probably some sort of a luck that I've not seen anybody who has had any significant hemorrhage.
When you counsel a patient who's about to begin chemo bevacizumab, what number do you give them as a risk for hemorrhage?
Well, the risk for hemorrhage is less than 5%. So I think that it's 4.7% and the fatal is 1.8% or 1.9% if the FDA changed it to 2.3%. So I think those are the numbers which are floated. So if it is less than 5%, is probably the message which is given to the patient.
How do the patients respond to that?
The patients are concerned to a certain extent, but the thing is that they're also excited by the fact that there is improvement in survival. So a patient who's got significant coronary artery disease, I would probably shy away from giving him bevacizumab.
Any thoughts about why you think this might be going on? People have talked about maybe it's part of a response. What do you think?
The hemorrhage is a part of the response. There is cavitation in the tumor, but see, we excluded patients with squamous cell carcinoma, so we do not have a real clear picture whether it was the cavitation in the tumors which is causing the hemorrhage. But it is a class effect. We know that.
Do you think that that's going to be a concern in the adjuvant setting? I mean, people are thinking that it might not be because it's microscopic disease.
Yeah, there is no evidence of tumor. That's one thing. And provided there are no surgical complications, I think that the patients will be able to tolerate it. But I think that the critical part of the study is accruing the first 100 patients.
One final question about adjuvant has to do with patients with potential enriched response to EGFR and whether or not there's a role, for example, in a non-smoker or a patient with a known EGFR mutation of erlotinib as adjuvant therapy in addition to chemo.
Not outside of a clinical trial at this present point in time. I think that we need to learn from the clinical studies. There is an ongoing clinical study which is looking at Tarceva following chemotherapy versus observation. I think it will be a very difficult call. And I think that is one lesson to be learned from advanced disease, because we saw that in the first line metastatic disease, we have not seen a clear role of EGFR inhibitors in unselected patient populations.
I mean, that's the key. You know, people always talk about, suppose you'd studied trastuzumab without knowing about HER2, you'd have no idea what's going on. But, you know, particularly at the last ASCO meeting, you're starting to see some pretty high response rates when you look at enriched populations.
Right. But the thing is that if you have, there were 1,000 patients in the Spanish trial, it came down to 427, then there was incidence of mutation was in 63, they took 48 patients into the target trial and saw a 75% response rate. I think that is very, very encouraging, but I think we need to get there.
Non-smoker, known EGFR mutation, how do you approach that decision?
If you have a known EGFR mutation in a non-smoker, Asian ethnicity, a woman with bronchoalveolar cell carcinoma, I would have no trouble giving the EGFR inhibitor as first line. But unselected patients, all, I would not do it. So in selected patients, yes.
What are your thoughts about the combination of erlotinib and bevacizumab? There was some more data presented at ASCO on that.
I think it is a combination worth pursuing further. And a definitive phase 3 trial is warranted in the second line setting. So it was a second line trial comparing chemotherapy to chemotherapy and bevacizumab and erlotinib and bevacizumab. So those are the three arms of the trial. It was just presented yesterday at the Prague meeting, actually, updated at the Prague meeting. And I'm one of the authors on the study.
Can you go through the trial a little bit in terms of what was seen?
The clinical trial showed that the progression-free survival is superior in the chemotherapy plus bevacizumab arm and in the Tarceva and bevacizumab arm by about 50%
compared to chemotherapy
alone.
Was that persuasive enough for you to consider that doublet in a non-protocol setting?
No, I think that we are jumping the gun here by pursuing it. It is expensive chemotherapy. I think we need a definitive trial. So if I were to probably consider a clinical study, I would compare chemotherapy to erlotinib and bevacizumab in the second line setting. So second line is a selected patient population. So they've gone from that first line. 40% of the patients have selected themselves to go to the second line setting. I think they should do a definite study.
Let's talk a little bit about stage 3 disease. Can you talk a little bit about some of the new data sets that have come out in that disease and how you approach these patients?
I think we have not seen a great deal of data in stage 3 unresectable disease. Concurrent chemoradiotherapy continues to be the standard of care. So more than 50% of the physicians or oncologists give a weekly carboplatin Taxol and radiation therapy, followed by some sort of a consolidation. Most of them use Taxotere based on SWOG-9504. And the remaining 30-40% of them use cisplatin VP16 with radiation with or without consolidation docetaxel. Whether consolidation docetaxel will prove to be of benefit from the HOG study, which has been completed and is awaiting analysis, and hopefully we'll see results within the next year, will prove anything, I doubt.
Why is that?
Because it is a small trial, and I think with 260 patients, it'll be hard to make any conclusive decisions that additional consolidation really does benefit, because it was based on the SWOG-9504 numbers, and in a randomized setting, they may not really hold true.
What about tolerance of that regimen? They have presented some data on that.
Yeah, it was tough to tolerate, to give Taxotere after platinum VP16 radiation. They did have significant issues with pneumonitis and toxicities and completion of the consolidation.
Seems that some of that also was related to neutropenia, and I'm hearing a lot of people now talking about using preemptive growth factors when maintenance docetaxel is used. Do you subscribe to that?
I think that is probably, in the state of Florida, it is mandated to use growth factors with a Taxotere-based regimen in metastatic disease also, meaning they have it as primary prophylaxis.
Interesting.
So when I run a study and it has a taxotere-containing regimen, they want to give primary prophylaxis with Neulasta in Florida, only in Florida.
When you use chemoradiation therapy, which regimen do you tend to utilize, and do you use the maintenance docetaxel?
I do.
So exactly what do?
I do weekly carboplatin taxol radiation outside of a context of a clinical trial, weekly carboplatin taxol radiation followed by 3 cycles of docetaxel.
With Neulasta?
I don't give primary prophylaxis, but if they get into trouble with the first cycle, I give it to them with the second.
How do you find patients responding to that whole regimen?
The first part of the regimen is the easiest regimen that you can ever give a patient with lung cancer. So even if an 80-year-old patient comes in, the weekly carboplatin taxol radiation is a breeze. The docetaxel is a little bit difficult. So about 75 to 80% of the patients I'm able to give, and 20% of them I don't give.
What makes it difficult specifically?
Just the general condition of the patient and the way they have tolerated the upfront combined chemotherapy and radiation and the amount of fatigue and exhaustion they have been through. I weigh the risks and benefits, and if I think that they're not going to benefit from additional chemotherapy, because we have not really proven the advantage of giving consolidation, it is based on just phase 2 clinical trials.
What are some of the new research questions that are going to be asked, or you'd like to see asked in stage 3 disease?
In stage 3 disease, I would like to see actually a regimen which has been given at full doses in combination with radiation.
Which regimen?
Being given. So I think the drug that I see which can be administered is probably Alimta. If Alimta-based combinations, as CLGB has started to show that they can give full doses of Alimta with carboplatin ACO5 in combination with radiation therapy, then this notion about giving cisplatin VP16 at full doses in combination with radiation therapy can somehow be altered. And the second is that if you can actually decrease the toxicity with something, I don't know what it will be. It'll be a gene or a growth factor. But we would also like to see the incorporation of these targeted agents in combination with radiation therapy to get pilot data. If Erbitux in combination with radiation is beneficial to patients with head and neck cancer, why should it not be beneficial to patients with esophageal and lung cancer?
Is that being studied?
It is being studied.
What's the trial?
The trial is upfront cetuximab with radiation and then consolidation.
Has panitumumab been looked at in lung cancer?
Right. So panitumumab has been looked at in lung cancer, but the early data was provocative because the median survivals were close to 14 months in the first few patients which were treated. But then a randomized phase 2 trial which was conducted, carboplatin taxol versus carboplatin taxol and panitumumab, did not show a signal of taking it ahead.
What about panitumumab radiation in lung cancer?
I don't recall of any such research being conducted at the present point in time, because after that metastatic disease study, I think they concentrated all their efforts somewhere else.
What about TKIs, erlotinib, and bevacizumab combined with radiation therapy?
Bevacizumab is being combined with radiation therapy. There is a proposal on the table to incorporate bevacizumab at various points. It's either with consolidation chemotherapy or from day 1 onwards with concurrent chemoradiotherapy or from day 8 onwards with concurrent chemoradiotherapy.
Any particular concerns from a safety perspective?
I think that is to get safety data.
I guess the question would be, getting back to the thing that most people are concerned about is pulmonary hemorrhage. I would assume that's the biggest concern.
It is. I think that's why, whether it will be beneficial to give it during the consolidation phase to get the advantage after they have been treated with chemoradiation, or to incorporate it in the middle of the treatment when they have already had some evidence of shrinkage and fibrosis and response.
So maybe that possibly the radiation might prevent the hemorrhage?
That is known to happen, that if you give the radiation therapy up front to the centrally located lesion, you could give the bevacizumab thereafter.
There's been this debate, and just getting back to the hemorrhage thing, about whether it really is geography or histology. It sounds like you kind of believe sort of in both.
I think it is, at this point in time, based on the analysis of the data, it is the histology.
Mainly. How about the location?
The location also matters, but it has not been proven.
So you just have the gut feeling that it does, but it hasn't been proven?
Yeah, it is a gut feeling. It is not based on any substantial data.
Let's move on to metastatic disease. What are some of the trials, agents, regimens that are being looked at right now that you're most excited about?
I think there are lots of targeted agents which are being looked at in combination with chemotherapy. So chemotherapy plus minus the drugs are being looked at. The VEGF tyrosine kinase inhibitors or small molecule VEGF inhibitors are probably in the forefront. As two of them are approved for renal cell cancer, they are being studied in lung cancer.
What has been seen so far?
Meaning there is only safety data available. There is not really a whole lot of information from those randomized clinical trials.
It's interesting, though. I think, at least with sunitinib, they've seen pulmonary hemorrhage.
Right, right. With single agent.
Right. Can you talk a little bit about how you approach sequentially first, second, and third line therapy of metastatic disease, both in the younger, healthier patient and the patient with poor performance status?
Let's take the second question first. If we take a look at patients who have poor performance status, I primarily look at comorbid conditions which the patient has. If the patient has significant comorbid illnesses, emphysema is not able to tolerate, is oxygen dependent, then I would suggest proceeding with just one drug.
Which one, generally?
And so a weekly Taxol, weekly Taxotere, or a single agent gemcitabine are probably reasonable alternatives, and I would discard the platinum in that patient. I don't give two drugs in that patient. But if the patient has performance status 2 because of aggressive tumor burden and no comorbid illnesses, then I usually prefer to give them a two-drug combination to start with so as to get the maximum effect up front.
Plus Bev?
You could give Bev if it is adenocarcinoma or non-squamous cell. Then in patients with the first-line, healthy patients get two-drug combinations, plus minus Bev, depending on their eligibility, Bev eligibility.
What chemo regimens do you tend to utilize?
So at this point in time, we were utilizing all the regimens. Now we are restricted because the approval is only with one regimen. And the third-party payers will have a difficulty paying for it.
So you're giving carbotaxol?
We have to give them carbotaxol in the advanced disease setting.
What about nab-paclitaxel? What are your thoughts about that, and what do we know about that in lung cancer?
I think it is a good drug. The activity in combination with carboplatin is good, but there are no definitive trials as of yet.
The advantage, of course, in breast cancer, it's starting to get used, and there you have the issue of the shorter infusion time and right. The lack of pre-medications, which is, seems to be valued, at least in that patient population. How do you think that's going to play out in the lung cancer population?
I think it will play out the same way as in the breast cancer population, because if you give it over a short infusion time and there is no hypersensitivity reactions, it will actually make it easier for the patient to take, even if the activity is the same and there is actually less toxicity. So we have to really, really find out whether there is less toxicity. The exciting part of that compound is that if the theoretical aspects and the preclinical data which exist with SPARC expression, which patients have a poor prognosis, then I think that that would be the study to do in that patient population to get the overall increase in survival, better efficacy.
Can you talk a little bit more about what SPARC is, what NAB is, and how they sort of interact?
Yeah, NAB actually does not nanoparticle Taxol. So NAB is just a 130 nanomolar size of that albumin molecule in which the paclitaxel is put in. That's why they called it NAB, based on the molecular weight, and it is albumin-coated paclitaxel. SPARC is just expressed in lung cancer, prostate cancer, head and neck cancer.
What is it?
It is a protein which is expressed, and patients who express that immunohistochemically have shown a poor outcome as compared to those who don't have it. It's the same as the ERCC1, as it was shown in patients in the IALT study, which was a New England Journal of Medicine paper.
But what is it? Is there a role of it, or is it a receptor? What is it?
No, it's just a protein.
Like just a protein.
Just a protein.
Hmm.
And what it does is that it probably attracts the albumin. So if you see the expression of SPARC, the expression of albumin is same as. So if it is preferentially in the tumors, then it will attract the albumin-coated to that area.
So that's the significance as opposed to pathogenically in the cancer.
Yeah, there is no mechanistic information as far as I know of.
So I guess the thought would be that perhaps in those patients you might see a higher response rate?
That's right. So if it preferentially goes to that area of the tumor and escapes from the normal cells, then you could make an argument that it would have a better degree of efficacy.
What clinical research data do we have right now with Abraxane and lung cancer?
Abraxane and lung cancer, they have single agent data from Dr. Rizvi's trial where it was given weekly at 125 milligrams per meter squared per week. The response rate was 27% in the frontline setting with single agent. Then they have combination with carboplatin, both every 3 weeks and then weekly. So every 3 weeks, the response rates are in the 25 to 27% range, giving at various doses. And with the weekly regimen of 100 milligrams per meter square, weekly with carboplatin AUC of 6, with nab-paclitaxel given 3 weeks on, 1 week off, the response rate was 50% in the 40 patients who were treated on trial.
If you put cost and reimbursement issues aside, do we have enough data right now that you would substitute nab for paclitaxel?
That's the question of the day. At this point in time, outside of a clinical trial, I am not doing it.
So you want to see more data?
I want to see more data. I want to see more data, especially with related to toxicity and also activity.
Toxicity,
neuropathy.
What do we know right now at this point?
And the weekly regimens are not really showing any substantial neuropathy. But with the every three-week regimen, there is still neuropathy, which was seen. And at 125 milligrams per meter squared dose, Dr. Rizvi's trial also showed neuropathy in the low teens.
Any other new agents or regimens coming down the pike that you're excited about?
Yeah, we are excited about a lot of agents. There are a couple BCL2 targeted compounds. There are five different HDAC inhibitors. Then there's a PARP inhibitor in clinical trials.
What about the design of studies and the whole approach to looking at new agents and regimens? So many of them are coming out. Are we going to have to shift the paradigm of how we study these agents? Are we going to be looking at more tissue correlative studies? Where are things heading?
Yeah, I think that we have to change the direction of clinical research because it has become too redundant to do these 1,000-patient trials and then not get an answer from them. And the bar has already been set high, especially in metastatic lung cancer, where bevacizumab has added to chemotherapy, has set that bar, which will be difficult to break at this point in time. So just to compare in a non-inferiority setting, addition of a third agent to standard chemotherapy is probably not going to cut it.
So what will cut it?
So what will cut it is that we need to probably find selected group of patients for selected agents based on either tumor characteristics or patient characteristics.
And are we making any progress?
I think we are making progress. The EGFR inhibitors are a prime example. And as I said, if you are able to get 10% of the patients with EGFR, 10% with something else, 10% with HDACs, 10% with the next group of compounds, I think that's the advance which is going to come. And we need to collect tissue on most patients. And there will be some sort of a regimented approach which will be mandated to all the clinical investigators.
Is that happening in lung cancer? You know, it's interesting. We just put together a book for the San Antonio Breast Cancer Meeting of current clinical trials in breast cancer.
Right.
And literally every single one has a tissue correlative study.
Right.
What about lung cancer?
In lung cancer also, there is one problem that in breast cancer, it is easier to get tissue. In
sure.
lung cancer, it is very difficult. It requires an invasive procedure. But I think that it is heading towards that direction. So if you are going to study a targeted agent where the efficacy, and based on what we have seen with exon 19 mutations, if the response rate is clearly 95%, I think that most patients will opt for a procedure to find out whether they are in that 95%. So I think that's what needs to be taken to the general internist and all other physicians so that that information is conveyed.
Yeah, you know, Roy Herbst and Ed Kim have this study where they're using biopsies to direct different targeted therapies. Is that a model that you see being repeated in other studies around the country?
There will be very many different models. So some could be based on pharmacogenomic efforts. So it could be just a sample of blood that tells you which combination to give. And some will be based on gene expression profiles and protein expression profiles. And a third group will be based on either these mutations, FISH, or a gene alteration.
Can you talk a little bit about small cell and what, if anything, has come out in the last couple of years that's clinically relevant from a clinical research perspective?
I think small cell continues to be small cell. It is still, the standard of care is the same, and not a great deal has changed at the present point in time. I think we need a couple oral agents in the second and third line setting, because there the patient's performance status drops significantly. And if you're able to get some degree of activity with these novel compounds, and I think that some of them merit evaluation in this setting. So the class of agents which actually you will see are the BCL2 BAX targeted compounds and the mTOR inhibitors, the APO2 trails, or some agents which cause proteolytic dysfunction or alteration.
You know, certainly when you compare it to non-small cell, you don't see the same patient numbers and, you know, morbidity and mortality, but you compare it to other tumors, and it's a significant tumor, yet, you know, it doesn't seem like there's that much research going on in it.
There is research, but it is not enough. The numbers have dropped from 20% to 13%. So amongst all lung cancers, it is now about 13 to 14% are small cell lung cancer. And most of them are being treated out there in the community because the response rate with standard treatments are high enough so that these patients don't show up for research studies. And it would be difficult actually to, again, compare it to the standard regimen in the frontline setting. So we need to develop, again, some select markers for select patients in the second line and recurrent disease where we can then take it to the frontline setting. And then I think bevacizumab as a class and VEGF-targeted compounds need to be evaluated here.
Have they been?
They have been in phase 2 studies, which have not been reported as of yet.
What about the front end of lung cancer prevention and screening? Anything new coming out there?
Well, the screening data from the 31,000 patients from the LCAP study was just published in the New England Journal of Medicine. The data is interesting, but it may not be applicable to the general population. The reason is that they found most of the patients to have stage 1A lung cancer on the screen patients.
This wasn't a randomized study.
It was not a randomized. It was a single-arm trial. It was not a trial. It was just data collection on a study where 31,000 patients had their scans, and they had the incidence and the prevalence scan, and the five-year survival is more than 88%. Which is actually significantly higher than what you would see in a population of patients who would present with stage 1A and 1B disease. So these are highly selected patients from highly selected centers who have been carefully screened. So one take on that from the editorial was that maybe we need to screen everybody so as to improve the overall survival of these patients. And that's the reason that their survival was higher. But I think the definitive objective from the screening studies should be lowering of the mortality of patients of the screen population as we see with cervical smears and mammography. And that has not been proven. So the NLST trial, which is a randomized trial, will be the definitive study which will probably answer that question or may not even answer the question.
Are they going to have enough events? And when do you think we'll see some answers?
Yeah, I think it will not be for another few years.
You know, if you sort of look at your own intuition, what do you think the role or value is of screening in high-risk patients?
I think imaging by itself is probably not enough. This is just my intuition, and this is no data. I think we need a marker in addition to the imaging study.
Any speculations on what that might be?
I don't have a clue.
What about chemo prevention?
So chemo prevention is probably the lesson that we learned from the screening studies is that these patients should go on all the chemo prevention trials. And if you're able to get those 31,000 patients into a chemo prevention study, I think that's where we will succeed in order to take the treatment to the next level.
Any agents that you think are promising?
Well, there are prostaglandin inhibitors and broccoli extracts and green tea, and these are being studied.
Any of them look promising to you?
At this point in time, there is no real data in lung cancer, as most of the data which was collected initially with retinoids failed to show an advantage.
If you kind of look at it from an overall cancer control perspective, where do you think the interventions are going to have to occur to really start to impact the mortality of this disease?
I think the intervention have to occur at the molecular level. in order to have an impact on the overall disease, that we need to find the biomarker discovery will be an individualized therapy. Biomarker discovery and individualized therapies are probably going to be the next step. And we need to continue to look for specific targeted agents which have an effect on particular receptors or genes or moieties or patient characteristics.
Do you think that the lung cancer, sort of the structure of clinical research on lung cancer, is going to lead to effective development and implementation of trials? Are we going to be able to get the adjuvant bevacizumab trial done in a quick, timely way? Are we going to be able to do these tissue types of studies or other predictive studies?
I think we do have the tools, but we don't have adequate resources. We have the tools, we have the intelligence, and we have the appropriate way of taking these studies to fruition. But we don't have adequate resources at this point in time. The institutions are actually changing their stance because they are moving from the academic mindset to a bottom line mindset. And that is going to hurt the overall research.